ooze, deep and honeyed with a power that commanded attention. If I closed my eyes, it was Joe, with the light glinting off his spectacles, and catching the gold tooth far back as he smiled. Then I opened my eyes again, half shocked, to see instead the crocodile's sinister yawn and the fire gold-green in the cold, cruel eyes. My mouth was dry, and there was a faint buzzing in my ears, weaving around the strong, sweet words. He was getting attention, all right. The night by the fire was full of eyes, black, wide and shiny, and small moans and shouts marked the pauses in the song. I closed my eyes and shook my head hard. I grabbed the edge of the wooden bench, clinging to its rough reality. I wasn't drunk. I knew. Whatever herb had been mixed with the rum was potent. I could feel it creeping snake-like through my blood and kept my eyes tight closed, fighting its progress. I couldn't block my ears, though, or the sound of that voice rising and falling. I didn't know how much time had passed. I came back to myself with a start, suddenly aware that the drum and the singing had stopped. There was an absolute silence around the fire. I could hear the small rush of flame and the rustle of cane leaves in the night wind, the quick darting scuttle of a rat in the palm frond roof of the hut behind me. The drug was still in my bloodstream, but the effects were dying. I could feel clarity coming back to my thoughts. Not so for the crowd. The eyes were fixed in a single unblinking stare, like a wall of mirrors. And I thought suddenly of the voodoo legends of my time, of zombies and the Ougon who made them. What had Geely said? Every legend has one foot on the truth. Ishmael spoke. He had taken off the crocodile's head. It lay on the ground at our feet, eyes gone dark in the shadow.
Ils sont arrivés, Ishmael said quietly. They have come.
He lifted his wet face lined with exhaustion and turned to the crowd.
Who asks?
As though in response, a young woman in a turban moved out of the crowd, still swaying, half dazed, and sank down on the ground before the dais. She put her hand on one of the carved images, a crude wooden icon in the shape of a pregnant woman. Her eyes looked up with hope, and while I didn't recognize the words she spoke, it was clear what she asked.
Aya, Gado.
The voice spoke from beside me, but it wasn't Margaret Campbell's. It was the voice of an old woman, cracked and high, but confident, answering in the affirmative. The young woman gasped with joy and prostrated herself on the ground. Ishmael nudged her gently with a foot. She got up quickly and backed into the crowd, clutching the small image, bobbing her head and murmuring, Mana, Mana, over and over. Next was a young man, by his face the brother of the first young woman, who squatted respectfully upon his haunches, touching his head before he spoke. Grand-mère, he began, in high nasal French. Grandmother, I thought. He asked his question, looking shyly down at the ground.
Does the woman I love return my love?
His was the jasmine spray. He held it so that it brushed the top of a bare, dusty foot. The woman beside me laughed, her ancient voice ironic, but not unkind.
Certainement, she answered. She returns it, and that of three other men besides. Find another, less generous, but more worthy.
The young man retired, crestfallen, to be replaced by an older man. This one spoke in an African language I didn't know, a tone of bitterness in his voice as he touched one of the clay figures.
Zetato Hoye, said.
Who? The voice had changed. The voice of a man this time, full grown but not elderly, answering in the same language with an angry tone. I stole a look to the side and, despite the heat of the fire, felt the chill ripple up my forearms. It was Margaret's face no longer. The outlines were the same, but the eyes were bright, alert and focused on the petitioner, the mouth set in grim command, and the pale throat swelled like a frog's with the effort of strong speech, as whoever it was argued with the man.
"They are here," Ishmael had said. "They, indeed."
He stood to one side, silent but watchful, and I saw his eyes rest on me for a second before coming back to Margaret.
Or whatever had been Margaret.
"They."
One by one the people came forward to kneel and ask. Some spoke in English, some French, or the slave patois, some in the African speech of their vanished homes. I couldn't understand all that was said, but when the questions were in French or English, they were often prefaced by a respectful grandfather or grandmother, once by aunt. Both the face and the voice of the oracle beside me changed as they came to answer their call, male and female, mostly middle-aged or old, their shadows dancing on her face with the flicker of the fire.
"Do you not sometimes imagine that you see things in the fire?"
The echo of her own small voice came back to me, thin and childish. Listening, I felt the hair rise on the back of my neck and understood for the first time what had brought Ishmael back to this place, risking recapture and renewed slavery. Not friendship, not love, nor any loyalty to his fellow slaves, but power. What price is there for the power to tell the future? "Any price," was the answer I saw, looking out at the rapt faces of the congregation. He had come back for Margaret. It went on for some time. I didn't know how long the drug would last, but I saw people here and there sink down to the ground and nod to sleep. Others melted silently back to the darkness of the huts, and after a time we were almost alone. Only a few remained around the fire, all men. They were all husky and confident, and from their attitude accustomed to command some respect, among slaves at least. They had hung back, together as a group, watching the proceedings, until at last one, clearly the leader, stepped forward.
"They be done, mon," he said to Ishmael, with a jerk of his head toward the sleeping forms around the fire. "Now you ask."
Ishmael's face showed nothing but a slight smile, yet he seemed suddenly nervous. Perhaps it was the closing in of the other men. There was nothing overtly menacing about them, but they seemed both serious and intent, not upon Margaret for a change, but upon Ishmael. At last he nodded and turned to face Margaret. During the hiatus, her face had gone blank. No one at home.
"Bwasa," he said to her. "Come you, Bwasa."
I shrank involuntarily away as far as I could get on the bench without falling into the fire.
Whoever Bwasa was, he had come promptly. "I be hearing."
It was a voice as deep as Ishmael's and should have been as pleasant. It wasn't. One of the men took an involuntary step backward. Ishmael stood alone. The other men seemed to shrink away from him as though he suffered some contamination.
"Tell me what I want to know, you Bwasa," he said.
Margaret's head tilted slightly, a light of amusement in the pale blue eyes.
"What you want to know," the deep voice said with mild scorn. "For why, mon? You be going. I tell you anything or not."
The small smile on Ishmael's face echoed that on Bwasa's.
"You say true," he said softly. "But these..."
He jerked his head toward his companions, not taking his eyes from the face.
"They be going with me."
"Might as well,"
the deep voice said. It chuckled rather unpleasantly.
"The maggot dies in 3 days. Won't be nothing for them here. That all you be wanting with me?"
Not waiting for an answer, Bwasa yawned widely, and a loud belch erupted from Margaret's dainty mouth. Her mouth closed, and her eyes resumed their vacant stare, but the men weren't noticing. An excited chatter erupted from them, to be hushed by Ishmael with a significant glance at me. Abruptly quiet, they moved away, still muttering, glancing at me as they went. Ishmael closed his eyes as the last man left the clearing, and his shoulders sagged. I felt a trifle drained myself.
What?
I began, and then stopped. Across the fire, a man had stepped from the shelter of the sugar cane. Jamie, tall as the cane itself, with the dying fire staining shirt and face as red as his hair. He raised a finger to his lips, and I nodded. I gathered my feet cautiously beneath me, picking up my stained skirt in one hand. I could be up, past the fire, and into the cane with him before Ishmael could reach me. But Margaret... I hesitated, turned to look at her, and saw that her face had come alive once again. It was lifted, eager, lips parted, and shining eyes narrowed so that they seemed slightly slanted as she stared across the fire.
"Daddy,"
said Brianna's voice beside me. The hairs rippled softly erect on my forearms. It was Brianna's voice, Brianna's face, blue eyes dark and slanting with eagerness.
"Bree,"
I whispered, and the face turned to me.
"Mama,"
said my daughter's voice from the throat of the oracle.
"Brianna,"
said Jamie, and she turned her head sharply to look at him.
"Daddy,"
she said with great certainty,
"I knew it was you. I've been dreaming about you."
Jamie's face was white with shock. I saw his lips form the word Jesus without sound, and his hand moved instinctively to cross himself.
"Don't let Mama go alone," said the voice with great certainty. "You go with her. I'll keep you safe."
There was no sound save the crackling of the fire. Ishmael stood transfixed, staring at the woman beside me. Then she spoke again, in Brianna's soft, husky tones.
"I love you, Daddy. You too, Mama."
She leaned toward me and I smelled the fresh blood. Then her lips touched mine and I screamed. I wasn't conscious of leaping to my feet or of crossing the clearing. All I knew was that I was clinging to Jamie, my face buried in the cloth of his coat, shaking. His heart was pounding under my cheek, and I thought that he was shaking too. I felt his hand trace the sign of the cross upon my back, and his arm locked tight about my shoulders.
"It's all right," he said,
and I could feel his ribs swell and brace with the effort of keeping his voice steady.
"She's gone."
I didn't want to look, but forced myself to turn my head toward the fire. It was a peaceful scene. Margaret Campbell sat quietly on her bench, humming to herself, twiddling a long black tail feather upon her knee. Ishmael stood behind her, one hand smoothing her hair in what looked like tenderness. He murmured something to her in a low, liquid tongue. A question. And she smiled placidly.
"Oh, I'm not a scrap tired," she assured him, turning to look fondly up into the scarred face that hovered in the darkness above her. "Such a nice party, wasn't it?"
"Yes, baby," he said gently. "But you rest now, eh?"
He turned and clicked his tongue loudly. Suddenly, two of the turbaned women materialized out of the night. They must have been waiting just within call. Ishmael said something to them, and they came at once to tend Margaret, lifting her to her feet and leading her away between them, murmuring soft endearments in African and French. Ishmael remained, watching us across the fire. He was still as one of Gili's idols, carved out of night.
"I did not come alone," Jamie said.
He gestured casually over his shoulder toward the cane field behind him, implying armed regiments.
"Oh, you be alone, mon," Ishmael said with a slight smile. "No matter. The Loa speak to you. You be safe from me."
He glanced back and forth between us, appraising.
"Ah," he said, in a tone of interest. "Never did hear a Loa speak to Bukra."
He shook his head then, dismissing the matter.
"You be going now,"
he said, quietly but with considerable authority. Not yet. Jamie's arm dropped from my shoulder, and he straightened up beside me.
I've come for the boy, Ian. I will not go without him.
Ishmael's brows went up, compressing the three vertical scars between them.
Ah, he said again. You forget that boy. He be gone.
Gone where? Jamie asked sharply. The narrow head tilted to one side as Ishmael looked him over carefully.
Gone with a maggot, mon, he said. And where she go, you don't be going. That boy gone, mon, he said again with finality. You leave too. You a wise man.
He paused, listening. A drum was talking, somewhere far away, the pulse of it little more than a disturbance of the night air.
The rest be coming soon, he remarked. You safe from me, mon, not from them.
Who are the rest? I asked. The terror of the encounter with the lower was ebbing, and I was able to talk once more, though my spine still rippled with fear of the dark cane field at my back.
Maroons, I expect, Jamie said.
He raised a brow at Ishmael.
Or you will be.
The priest nodded, one formal bob of the head.
That be true, he said. You hear Bwasa speak. His loa bless us. We go.
He gestured toward the huts and the dark hills behind them.
The drum calling them down from the hills, those strong enough to go.
He turned away, the conversation obviously at an end.
Wait, Jamie said. Tell us where she's gone. Mrs. Abernathy and the boy.
Ishmael turned back, shoulders mantled in the crocodile's blood.
To Abandawe, he said.
And where's that? Jamie demanded impatiently. I put a hand on his arm. I know where it is, I said, and Ishmael's eyes widened in astonishment. At least, I know it's on Hispaniola. Lawrence told me. That was what Geely wanted from him. To find out where it was.
What is it? A town? A village? Where?
I could feel Jamie's arm tense under my hand, vibrating with the urgency to be gone. It's a cave, I said, feeling cold in spite of the balmy air and the nearness of the fire. An old cave.
A Bandawe, a magic place,
Ishmael put in, deep voice soft, as though he feared to speak of it out loud. He looked at me hard, reassessing.
Clotilda say the maggot take you to the room upstairs. You maybe be knowing what she do there.
A little. My mouth felt dry. I remembered Geely's hands, soft and plump and white, laying out the gems in their patterns, talking lightly of blood. As though he caught the echo of this thought, Ishmael took a sudden step toward me.
I ask you, woman, you still bleed?
Jamie jerked under my hand, but I squeezed his arm to be still. Yes, I said. Why? What has that to do with it? The Onisegan was plainly uneasy. He glanced from me back toward the huts. A stir was perceptible in the dark behind him. Many bodies were moving to and fro with a mutter of voices like the whisper of the cane fields. They were getting ready to go.
A woman bleeds, she kill magic. You bleed, got your woman power. The magic don't work for you. The old women do magic. Witch someone. Call the loas. Make sick, make well.
He gave me a long, appraising look and shook his head.
You ain't going do the magic what the maggot do. That magic kill her, sure. But it kill you too.
He gestured behind him toward the empty bench.
You hear Bwasa speak. He say the maggot die 3 days. She taken the boy. He die. You go follow them, mon. You die too, sure.
He stared at Jamie and raised his hands in front of him, wrists crossed as though bound together.
I tell you, Amiki, he said.
He let his hands fall, jerking them apart, breaking the invisible bond. He turned abruptly and vanished into the darkness, where the shuffle of feet was growing louder, punctuated with bumps as heavy objects were shifted.
This ends Disc 34. Voyager, Disc 35.
Holy Michael defend us, muttered Jamie. He ran a hand hard through his hair, making fiery wisps stand out in the flickering light. The fire was dying fast, with no one left to tend it.
Do you ken this place, Sassenach, where Gielis has gone with Ian?
No. All I know is that it's somewhere up in the far hills on Hispaniola, and that a stream runs through it.
Then we must take Stern, he said with decision. Come on, the lads are by the river with the boat.
I turned to follow him, but paused on the edge of the cane field to look back. Jamie, look! Behind us lay the embers of the Ergungun's fire and the shadowy ring of slave huts. Further away, the bulk of Rose Hall made a light patch against the hillside. But farther still, beyond the shoulder of the hill, the sky glowed faintly red.
That will be Howe's place burning, he said.
He sounded oddly calm, without emotion. He pointed to the left, toward the flank of the mountain, where a small orange dot glowed, no more at this distance than a pinprick of light.
And that will be 12 trees, I expect.
The drum voice whispered through the night, up and down the river. What had Ishmael said?
The drum calling them down from the hills, those strong enough to go.
A small line of slaves was coming down from the huts, women carrying babies and bundles, cooking pots slung over their shoulders, heads turbaned in white. Next to one young woman, who held her arm with careful respect, walked Margaret Campbell, likewise turbaned. Jamie saw her and stepped forward.
Miss Campbell, he said sharply. Margaret!
Margaret and her attendant stopped. The young woman moved as though to step between her charge and Jamie, but he held up both hands as he came to show he meant no harm, and she reluctantly stepped back.
Margaret, he said.
Margaret, do you not know me?
She stared vacantly at him. Very slowly he touched her, holding her face between his hands.
Margaret,
he said to her, low-voiced, urgent.
Margaret, hear me. Do you ken me, Margaret?
She blinked once, then twice, and the smooth, round face melted and thawed into life. It wasn't like the sudden possession of the Loas. This was a slow, tentative coming of something shy and fearful.
I ken you, Jamie, she said at last.
Her voice was rich and pure, a young girl's voice. Her lips curled up and her eyes came alive once more, her face still held in the hollow of his hands.
It's been long since I saw you, Jamie, she said, looking up into his eyes. Will you have word of Ewan, then? Is he well?
He stood very still for a minute, his face that careful blank mask that hid strong feeling.
He is well, he whispered at last. Very well, Margaret. He gave me this, to keep until I saw you.
He bent his head and kissed her gently. Several of the women had stopped, standing silently by to watch. At this they moved and began to murmur, glancing uneasily at each other. When he released Margaret Campbell and stepped back, they closed in around her, protective and wary, nodding him back. Margaret seemed oblivious. Her eyes were still on Jamie's face, the smile on her lips.
"I thank you, Jamie,"
she called, as her attendant took her arm and began to urge her away.
"Tell you, and I'll be with them soon."
The little band of white-clothed women moved away, disappearing like ghosts into the darkness by the cane field. Jamie made an impulsive move in their direction, but I stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Let her go," I whispered,
mindful of what lay on the floor in the salon of the plantation house.
"Jamie, let her go.
You can't stop her. She's better with them." He closed his eyes briefly, then nodded.
"Aye, you're right."
He turned. then stopped suddenly, and I whirled about to see what he had seen. There were lights in Rose Hall now. Torchlight flickering behind the windows, upstairs and down. As we watched, a surly glow began to swell in the windows of the secret workroom on the second floor.
"It's past time to go," Jamie said.
He seized my hand, and we went quickly, diving into the dark rustle of the canes, fleeing through air suddenly thick with the smell of burning sugar. Chapter 62
Abandawi.
"You can take the governor's pinnace. That's small, but it's seaworthy." Gray fumbled through the drawer of his desk. "I'll write an order for the dockers to hand it over to you."
"Aye, we'll need the boot. I canna risk the Artemis, as she's Jared's. But I think we'd best steal it, John."
Jamie's brows were drawn together in a frown.
"I wouldna have ye be involved with me in any visible way."
"Aye, you'll be having trouble enough with things without that." Gray smiled unhappily.
"Trouble? Yes, you might call it trouble, with 4 plantation houses burnt and over 200 slaves gone, God knows where. But I vastly doubt that anyone will take notice of my social acquaintance under the circumstances. Between fear of the Maroons and fear of the Chinamen, the whole island is in such panic that a mere smuggler is the most negligible of trivialities."
"It's a great relief to me to be thought trivial," Jamie said very dryly.
"Still, we'll steal the boot. And if we're taken, you've never heard my name or seen my face, aye?"
Gray stared at him, a welter of emotions fighting for mastery of his features, amusement, fear, and anger among them.
"Is that right?" he said at last. "Let you be taken, watch them hang you, and keep quiet about it, for fear of smirching my reputation? For God's sake, Jamie, what do you take me for?"
Jamie's mouth twitched slightly.
"For a friend, John," he said. "And if I'll take your friendship and your damn boot, then you'll take mine and keep quiet, aye?"
The governor glared at him for a moment, lips pressed tight, but then his shoulders sagged in defeat.
"I will," he said shortly. "But I should regard it as a great personal favour if you would endeavour not to be captured."
Jamie rubbed a knuckle across his mouth, hiding a smile.
"I'll try very hard, John."
The governor sat down wearily. There were deep circles under his eyes, and his impeccable linen was wilted. Obviously, he hadn't changed his clothes from the day before.
"All right. I don't know where you're going, and it's likely better I don't. But if you can, keep out of the sea lanes north of Antigua. I sent a boat this morning to ask for as many men as the barracks there can supply, marines and sailors both. They'll be heading this way by the day after tomorrow at the latest, to guard the town and harbour against the escaped Maroons in case of an outright rebellion."
I caught Jamie's eye and raised one brow in question, but he shook his head almost imperceptibly. We had told the governor of the uprising on the Yala's River and the escape of the slaves, something he had heard about from other sources anyway. We hadn't told him what we had seen later that night, lying to under cover of a tiny cove, sails taken down to hide their whiteness. The river was dark as onyx, but with a fugitive gleam from the broad expanse of water. We had heard them coming, and had time to hide before the ship came down upon us, the beating of drums and a savage exultation of many voices echoing through the river valley as the Bruja sailed past us, carried by the downward current. The bodies of the pirates, no doubt, lay somewhere upriver, left to rot peacefully among the frangipani and cedar. The escaped slaves of the Yala's River hadn't gone into the mountains of Jamaica, but out to sea, presumably to join Bouassa's followers on Hispaniola. The townsfolk of Kingston had nothing to fear from the escaped slaves, but it was a good deal better that the Royal Navy should concentrate their attention here than on Hispaniola, where we were bound. Jamie rose to take our leave, but Gray stopped him.
"Wait.
Will you not require a safe place for your... for Mrs. Fraser?
He didn't look at me, but at Jamie, eyes steady.
I should be honoured if you would entrust her to my protection. She could stay here in the residence until you return. No one would trouble her, or even need to know she was here.
Jamie hesitated, but there was no gentle way to phrase it.
She must go with me, John, he said. There's no choice about it. She must.
Gray's glance flickered to me, then away, but not before I had seen the look of jealousy in his eyes. I felt sorry for him, but there was nothing I could say. No way to tell him the truth.
Yes, he said,
and swallowed noticeably.
I see. Quite.
Jamie held out a hand to him. He hesitated for a moment, but then took it.
Good luck, Jamie, he said,
voice a little husky.
God go with you.
Fergus had been somewhat more difficult to deal with. He had insisted absolutely on accompanying us, offering argument after argument, and arguing the more vehemently when he found that the Scottish smugglers would sail with us.
You'll take them, but you will go without me.
Fergus's face was alive with indignation.
I will,
Jamie said firmly.
The smugglers are widowers or bachelors or, but you're a married man.
He glanced pointedly at Massali, who stood watching the discussion, her face drawn with anxiety.
I thought she was ower young to be wed, and I was wrong. But I know she's ower young to be widowed. You'll stay.
And he turned aside. The matter settled. It was full dark when we set sail in Gray's pinnace, a 30-foot single-decked sloop, leaving two docksmen bound and gagged in the boathouse behind us. It was a small, single-masted ship, bigger than the fishing boat in which we had travelled up the Yala's River, but barely large enough to qualify for the designation ship. Nonetheless, she seemed seaworthy enough, and we were soon out of Kingston Harbour, heeling over in a brisk evening breeze, on our way toward Hispaniola. The smugglers handled the sailing among them, leaving Jamie, Lawrence, and I to sit on one of the long benches along the rail. We chatted desultorily of this and that, but after a time fell silent, absorbed in our own thoughts. Jamie yawned repeatedly, and finally, at my urging, consented to lie down upon the bench, his head resting in my lap. I was myself strung too tightly to want to sleep. Lawrence, too, was wakeful, staring upward into the sky, hands folded behind his head.
There is moisture in the air tonight, he said,
nodding upward toward the silver sliver of the crescent moon.
See the haze about the moon? It may rain before dawn. Unusual for this time of year.
Talk about the weather seemed sufficiently boring to soothe my jangled nerves. I stroked Jamie's hair, thick and soft under my hand. Is that so? I said. You and Jamie both seem able to read the weather from the sky.
All I know is the old bit about red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky at morning, sailor take warning. I didn't notice what colour the sky was tonight, did you?
Lawrence laughed comfortably.
Rather a light purple, he said. I cannot say whether it will be red in the morning, but it is surprising how frequently such signs are reliable. But, of course, there is a scientific principle involved, the refraction of light from the moisture in the air, just as I observed presently of the moon.
I lifted my chin, enjoying the breeze that lifted the heavy hair that fell on my neck. But what about odd phenomena, supernatural things? I asked him. What about the things where the rules of science seem not to apply?
I am a scientist,
I heard him say in memory, his slight accent seeming only to reinforce his matter-of-factness.
I don't believe in ghosts. Such as what, these phenomena?
Well, I groped for a moment, then fell back on Geely's own examples. People who have bleeding stigmata, for example. Astral travel, visions, supernatural manifestations. Odd things that can't be explained rationally. Lawrence grunted and settled his bulk more comfortably on the bench beside me.
Well,
I say it is the place of science only to observe, he said, to seek cause where it may be found, but to realize that there are many things in the world for which no cause shall be found, not because it doesn't exist, but because we know too little to find it. It isn't the place of science to insist on explanation, but only to observe, in hopes that the explanation will manifest itself.
That may be science, but it isn't human nature, I objected.
People go on wanting explanations.
They do.
He was becoming interested in the discussion. He leaned back, folding his hands across his slight paunch in a lecturer's attitude.
It is for this reason that a scientist constructs hypotheses, suggestions for the cause of an observation. But a hypothesis must never be confused with an explanation, with proof. I have seen a great many things which might be described as peculiar. Fish falls, for instance, where a great many fish, all of the same species, mind you, all the same size, fall suddenly from a clear sky over dry land. There would appear to be no rational cause for this, and yet is it therefore suitable to attribute the phenomenon to supernatural interference? On the face of it, does it seem more likely that some celestial intelligence should amuse itself by flinging shoals of fish at us from the sky? Or that there is some meteorological phenomenon, a waterspout, a tornado, something of the kind, that while not visible to us, is still in operation? And yet,
his voice became more pensive.
Why? And how might a natural phenomenon, such as a waterspout, remove the heads, and only the heads, of all the fish?
Have you seen such a thing yourself? I asked, interested. And he laughed.
There speaks a scientific mind, he said, chuckling. The first thing a scientist asks, how do you know? Who has seen it? Can I see it myself? Yes, I have seen such a thing. 3 times, in fact, though in one case the precipitation was of frogs rather than fish.
Were you near a seashore or a lake?
Once near a shore, once near a lake. That was the frogs. But the 3rd time, it took place far inland, some 20 miles from the nearest body of water. And yet the fish were of a kind I have seen only in the deep ocean. In none of the cases did I see any sort of disturbance of the upper air. No clouds, no great wind, none of the fabled spouts of water that rise from the sea into the sky, assuredly. And yet the fish fell. So much is a fact, for I have seen them.
And it isn't a fact if you haven't seen it? I asked dryly. He laughed in delight, and Jamie stirred, murmuring against my thigh. I smoothed his hair, and he relaxed into sleep again.
It may be so, it may not. But a scientist couldn't say, could he? What is it the Christian Bible says? Blessed are they who have not seen but have believed.
That's what it says, yes.
Some things must be accepted as fact without provable cause.
He laughed again, this time without much humour.
As a scientist who is also a Jew, I have perhaps a different perspective on such phenomena as stigmata, and the idea of resurrection of the dead, which a very great proportion of the civilised world accepts as fact beyond question. And yet, this sceptical view is not one I could even breathe to anyone save yourself, without grave danger of personal harm. Doubting Thomas was a Jew after all, I said, smiling, to begin with. Yes, and only when he ceased to doubt did he become a Christian and a martyr. One could argue that it was surety that killed him, though.
His voice was heavy with irony.
There is a great difference between those phenomena which are accepted on faith and those which are proved by objective determination, though the cause of both may be equally rational once known. And the chief difference is this, that people will treat with disdain such phenomena as are proved by the evidence of the senses and commonly experienced, while they will defend to the death the reality of a phenomenon which they have neither seen nor experienced.
Faith is as powerful a force as science, he concluded, voice soft in the darkness, but far more dangerous. We sat quietly for a time, looking over the bow of the tiny ship, toward the thin slice of darkness that divided the night, darker than the purple glow of the sky or the silver-grey sea. The black island of Hispaniola drawing inexorably closer. "Where did you see the headless fish?" I asked suddenly, and was not surprised to see the faint inclination of his head toward the bow.
"There," he said. "I have seen a good many odd things among these islands, but perhaps more there than anywhere else. Some places are like that."
I didn't speak for several minutes, pondering what might lie ahead, and hoped that Ishmael had been right in saying that it was Ian whom Gilis had taken with her to Abandawi. A thought occurred to me, one that had been lost or pushed aside during the events of the last 24 hours. Lawrence, the other Scottish boys, Ishmael told us he saw 12 of them, including Ian. When you were searching the plantation, did you find any trace of the others? He drew in his breath sharply, but didn't answer at once. I could feel him turning over words in his mind, trying to decide how to say what the chill in my bones had already told me. The answer, when it came, wasn't from Lawrence, but from Jamie.
"We found them," he said softly from the darkness.
His hand rested on my knee and squeezed gently.
"Then I ask more, Sassenach, for I will not tell you."
I understood. Ishmael had to have been right. It must be Ian with Gili, for Jamie could bear no other possibility. I laid a hand on his head, and he stirred slightly, turning so that his breath touched my hand. "Blessed are they who have not seen," I whispered under my breath, "but have believed." We dropped anchor near dawn in a small nameless bay on the northern coast of Hispaniola. There was a narrow beach faced with cliffs, and through a split in the rock a narrow sandy trail was visible leading into the interior of the island. Jamie carried me the few steps to shore, set me down, and then turned to Innes, who had splashed ashore with one of the parcels of food.
"I thank you, Acharid," he said formally. "We shall part here. With the Virgin's blessing, we will meet here again in 4 days' time."
Inna's narrow face contracted in surprised disappointment. Then resignation settled on his features.
"Aye," he said. "I'll mind the booty then, till you all come back."
Jamie saw the expression and shook his head, smiling.
"Not just you, man. Did I need a strong arm, it would be yours I should call on first. No, all of you shall stay. Save my wife and the Jew."
Resignation was replaced by sheer surprise.
"Stay here? All of us? But will you not have need of us, MacDhu?"
He squinted anxiously at the cliffs with their burden of flowering vines.
"It looks a fearsome place to venture into without friends." "I shall count it the act of greatest friendship for you to wait here, as I say, Duncan," Jamie said.
And I realised with a slight shock that I had never known Innes's given name. Innes glanced again at the cliffs, his lean face troubled, then bent his head in acquiescence.
"Well, it's you we shall see, MacDhu. But ye ken we are willing, all of us."
Jamie nodded, his face turned away.
"Aye, I ken that fine, Duncan," he said softly.
Then he turned back, held out an arm, and Innes embraced him, his one arm awkwardly thumping Jamie's back.
"If a ship should come," Jamie said, letting go, "then I wish you to take heed for yourselves. The Royal Navy will be looking for that pinnace, aye. I doubt that they shall come here looking, but if they should, or if anything else at all should threaten you, then leave. Sail away at once."
"And leave you here?
Nay, you can order me to do a great many things, MacDhu, and do them I shall. but not that.
Jamie frowned and shook his head.
The rising sun struck sparks from his hair and the stubble of his beard, wreathing his head in fire.
It will do me and my wife no good to have you killed, Duncan. Mind what I see. If a ship comes, go.
He turned aside then and went to take leave of the other Scots. Innes sighed deeply, his face etched with disapproval, but he made no further protest. It was hot and damp in the jungle, and there was little talk among the three of us as we made our way inland. There was nothing to say, after all. Jamie and I couldn't speak of Brianna before Lawrence, and there were no plans to be made until we reached Abandawi and saw what was there. I dozed fitfully at night, waking several times to see Jamie back against a tree near me, eyes fixed sightless on the fire. At noon of the second day, we reached the place. A steep and rocky hillside of grey limestone rose before us, sprouted over with spiky aloes and a ruffle of coarse grass. And on the crest of the hill, I could see them. Great standing stones, megaliths, in a rough circle about the crown of the hill.
"You didn't say there was a stone circle," I said.
I felt faint, and not only from the heat and damp.
"Are you quite well, Mrs. Fraser?"
Lawrence peered at me in some alarm, his genial face flushed beneath its tan.
"Yes," I said.
But my face must, as usual, have given me away, for Jamie was there in a moment, taking my arm and steadying me with a hand about my waist.
"For God's sake, be careful, Sassenach," he muttered. "Do not go near those things."
"We have to know if Geely's there with Ian," I said. "Come on." I forced my reluctant feet into motion, and he came with me, still muttering under his breath in Gaelic. I thought it was a prayer.
"They were put up a very long time ago,"
Lawrence said, as we came up onto the crest of the hill within a few feet of the stones.
"Not by slaves, by the aboriginal inhabitants of the islands."
The circle was empty and innocent-looking. No more than a staggered circle of large stones set on end, motionless under the sun. Jamie was watching my face anxiously.
"Can you hear them, Claire?" he said.
Lawrence looked startled but said nothing as I advanced carefully toward the nearest stone.
"I don't know," I said. "It isn't one of the proper days, not a sun feast or a fire feast, I mean. It may not be open now. I don't know."
Holding tightly to Jamie's hand, I edged forward, listening. There seemed a faint hum in the air, but it might be no more than the usual sound of the jungle insects. Very gently, I laid the palm of my hand against the nearest stone. I was dimly conscious of Jamie calling my name. Somewhere my mind was struggling on a physical level, making the conscious effort to lift and lower my diaphragm, to squeeze and release the chambers of my heart. My ears were filled with a pulsating hum, a vibration too deep for sound that throbbed in the marrow of my bones. And in some small, still place in the centre of the chaos was Geely Duncan, green eyes smiling into mine.
"Claire!"
I was lying on the ground, Jamie and Lawrence bending over me, faces dark and anxious against the sky. There was a dampness on my cheeks, and a trickle of water ran down my neck. I blinked, cautiously moving my extremities, to be sure I still possessed them. Jamie put down the handkerchief with which he had been bathing my face, and lifted me to a sitting position.
"Are you all right, Sassenach?"
"Yes," I said, still mildly confused. "Jamie, she's here."
"Who? Mrs. Abernathy?"
Lawrence's heavy eyebrows shot up, and he glanced hastily behind him as though expecting her to materialize on the spot.
"I heard her, saw her, whatever."
My wits were coming slowly back. "She's here,"
Not in the circle. Close by.
Can you tell where?
Jamie's hand was resting on his dirk as he darted quick glances all around us. I shook my head and closed my eyes, trying, reluctantly, to recapture that moment of seeing. There was an impression of darkness, of damp coolness, and the flicker of red torchlight.
"I think she's in a cave," I said, amazed. "Is it close by, Lawrence?"
"It is," he said, watching my face with intense curiosity. "The entrance isn't far from here. Take us there."
Jamie was on his feet, lifting me to mine. "Jamie!" I stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Aye."
"Jamie, she knows I'm here, too."
That stopped him, all right.
He paused, and I saw him swallow. Then his jaw tightened, and he nodded.
"Avihil vianakach. Jianxin vonyanya,"
he said softly, and turned toward the edge of the hill. "Blessed Michael, defend us from demons." The blackness was absolute. I brought my hand to my face, felt my palm brush my nose, but saw nothing. It wasn't an empty blackness, though. The floor of the passage was uneven, with small, sharp particles that crunched underfoot, and the walls in some places grew so close together that I wondered how Geely had ever managed to squeeze through. Even in the places where the passage grew wider and the stone walls were too far away for my outstretched hands to brush against, I could feel them. It was like being in a dark room with another person, someone who kept quite silent, but whose presence I could feel never more than an arm's length away. Jamie's hand was tight on my shoulder, and I could feel his presence behind me, a warm disturbance in the cool void of the cave.
"Are we headed right?" he asked, when I stopped for a moment to catch my breath. "There are passages to the sides. I feel them as we pass. How can you tell where we're going?"
"I can hear. Hear them. It.
Don't you hear?"
It was a struggle to speak, to form coherent thoughts. The call here was different, not the beehive sound of Craigner Dunn, but a hum like the vibration of the air following the striking of a great bell. I could feel it ringing in the long bones of my arms, echoing through pectoral girdle and spine. Jamie gripped my arm hard.
"Stay with me," he said. "Sassenach, don't let it take you. Stay."
I reached blindly out, and he caught me tight against his chest. The thump of his heart against my temple was louder than the hum. "Jamie, Jamie, hold on to me." I had never been more frightened. "Don't let me go. If it takes me, Jamie, I can't come back again. It's worse every time. It will kill me, Jamie." His arms tightened round me till I felt my ribs crack and gasped for breath. After a moment he let go, and putting me gently aside, moved past me into the passage, taking care to keep his hand always on me.
"I'll go first," he said. "Put your hand in my belt and dinna let go for anything."
Linked together, we moved slowly down, farther into the dark. Lawrence had wanted to come, but Jamie wouldn't let him. We had left him at the mouth of the cave, waiting. If we shouldn't return, he was to go back to the beach to keep the rendezvous with Innes and the other Scots. If we shouldn't return. He must have felt my grip tighten, for he stopped and drew me alongside him.
"Claire," he said softly, "I must say something."
I knew already, and groped for his mouth to stop him, but my hand brushed by his face in the dark. He gripped my wrist and held tight.
"If it will be a choice between her and one of us, then it must be me. You know that, aye?"
I knew that. If Geely should be there still, and one of us might be killed in stopping her, it must be Jamie to take the risk. For with Jamie dead, I would be left, and I could follow her through the stone, which he could not. "I know," I whispered at last. I knew also what he didn't say, and what he knew as well, that should Gili have gone through already, then I must go as well.
"Then kiss me, Claire," he whispered, "and know that you are more to me than life, and I have no regret."
I couldn't answer, but kissed him. First his hand, its crooked fingers warm and firm, and the brawny wrist of a sword-wielder, and then his mouth, haven and promise and anguish, all mingled, and the salt of tears in the taste of him. Then I let go and turned toward the left-hand tunnel. "This way," I said. Within 10 paces, I saw the light. It was no more than a faint glow on the rocks of the passage, but it was enough to restore the gift of sight. Suddenly, I could see my hands and feet, though dimly. My breath came out in something like a sob of relief and fear. I felt like a ghost taking shape as I walked toward the light and the soft bell hum before me. The light was stronger now, then dimmed again as Jamie slid in front of me and his back blocked my view. Then he bent and stepped through a low archway. I followed and stood up in light. It was a good-sized chamber, the walls farthest away from the torch, still cold and black with the slumber of the cave. The wall before us had wakened, though. It flickered and gleamed, particles of embedded mineral reflecting the flames of a pine torch fixed in a crevice.
"So you came, did you?"
Gillis was on her knees, eyes fixed on a glittering stream of white powder that fell from her folded fist, drawing a line on the dark floor. I heard a small sound from Jamie, half relief, half horror, as he saw Ian. The boy lay in the middle of the pentacle on his side, hands bound behind him, gagged with a strip of white cloth. Next to him lay an axe. It was made of a shiny dark stone, like obsidian, with a sharp, chipped edge. The handle was covered with gaudy beadwork in an African pattern of stripes and zigzags.
"Don't come any closer, Fox."
Gili sat back on her heels, showing her teeth to Jamie in an expression that wasn't a smile. She held a pistol in one hand. Its fellow, charged and cocked, was thrust through the leather belt she wore about her waist. Eyes fixed on Jamie, she reached into the pouch suspended from the belt and withdrew another handful of diamond dust. I could see beads of sweat standing on her broad white brow. The bell hum from the time passage must be reaching her as it reached me. I felt sick, and the sweat ran down my body in trickles under my clothes. The pattern was almost finished. With the pistol carefully trained, she dribbled out the thin, shining stream until she had completed the pentagram. The stones were already laid inside it. They glinted from the floor in sparks of colour, connected by a gleaming line of poured quicksilver.
"There, then."
She sat back on her heels with a sigh of relief and wiped the thick, creamy hair back with one hand.
"Safe. The diamond dust keeps out the noise," she explained to me. "Nasty, isn't it?"
She patted Ian, who lay bound and gagged on the ground in front of her, his eyes wide with fear above the white cloth of the gag.
"There, there, Mukhir, dinna fret. It will be over soon."
"Take your hand off him, you wicked bitch."
Jamie took an impulsive step forward, hand on his dirk, then stopped as she lifted the barrel of the pistol an inch.
"You remind me of your Uncle Dougal, Arshunach," she said, tilting her head to one side coquettishly. "He was older when I met him than you are now, but you've the look of him about you, eh? Like you'd take what you pleased and damn anyone who stands in your way."
Jamie looked at Ian, curled on the floor, then up at Gili.
"I'll take what's mine," he said softly.
"But you can't now, can you?" she said pleasantly. "One more step and I kill you dead. I spare you now only because Claire seems fond of you."
Her eyes shifted to me, standing in the shadows behind Jamie. She nodded to me.
"A life for a life, sweet Claire. You tried to save me once on Craig na Dun. I saved you from the witch trial at Cranesmuir. We're quits now, aye?
Geely picked up a small bottle, uncorked it, and poured the contents carefully over Ian's clothes.